This week, we suspend our campaign. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you now. Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you
the Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace
To remind
Process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Welcome to episode 87. Today is September 11th, 2015. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
And this is Rob.
Our break music is provided once again by the Polish ambassador.
Woo!
And we have a very special guest with us this evening. Sue Meredith represents District 71 in the Missouri House of Representatives, which includes portions of Chesterfield, Creve Coeur, Maryland Heights, Olivet, Overland, and a large portion of unincorporated St. Louis County. She was elected to her first term in November 2012. Sue is a graduate of Pattonville High School. She holds a bachelor's degree in political science and a master's degree in legal studies, both from Webster University. Prior to her service in the Missouri House, Sue enjoyed a professional career with Webster University, a market research firm, a financial services firm, and as executive director of the Olivet Chamber of Commerce. Sue has done volunteer work with the Girl Scouts, the Women's Political Caucus, various PTA groups within the Rittner and Parkway school districts, and the Midwest Dance Theater Company. Sue currently volunteers as a court-appointed special advocate for the St. Louis County Courts, advocating for children removed from their homes due to abuse or neglect. She also serves as chair of the Children's Services Commission. We are thrilled to have Sue Meredith as our guest on the show. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So, first of all, we wanted to know a little bit about the legislative process from somebody on the inside. So the first question is, who writes a bill? Do you write it? Do you have staffers who write it? Do lobbyists write them for you?
Bills have to be, well, they're going to become law, which means that they're legal documents. We are not lawyers in the House. We have a few, but we're not. But most of us are not. And we have a department called Legislative Research. Legislative Research, at one point in time, wrote all of the bills for both houses, the House and the Senate.
Okay.
When you go to law school, they don't teach you how to write a bill. It's one thing they don't teach you how to do.
Yeah.
You only learn how to do that by working for a legislative body of some kind. It could be at a city for city ordinances or whatever. So what happened was somewhere along the line, the Senate decided that they, instead of using legal research, would use Senate research. So they created a new office within the Capitol called Senate Research. And they hired their own lawyers. And then the House decided, well, the Senate can have that, we can have that.
Of course.
Now, I understand why they want to do that. They want to keep things separate. But personally, when I want to write a bill, I went to House Research, as I was told to. I was going to be a good little doobie and try to follow directions.
Sure.
And I tried to write a bill for a friend of mine. And the person in legislative research couldn't understand what I was talking about. So I decided, okay, well, the person I was writing the bill for happened to have been a state representative back in the 80s. So I went to legislative research. And the person there called my friend, talked to him on the phone, came back and says, I think I've got it. We talked about it. He called my friend back. My friend said, yes, you do. And it's interesting now because we hear so much about unconstitutional bills, bills with unintended consequences. And I look at the bills, and at the very top of the bill, it has the bill number, and under that there's a double line, a heavy black line with a thinner black line above that. And to the left side of that, right above the lines, is a number, and that's that bill number. Well, the not the bill number, it's the proposal number. And there's either an S or an L or an H. And that signifies where it originated. And if you find a house bill that has some unintended consequences, or is maybe not constitutional, you can kind of tell where it came from.
So okay. do you outline kind of the general ideas that you want the bill to accomplish, and then they have to put kind of all the legalese around that? Or,
well, I go and I sit down with someone who specializes in that area, and I explain to them what I want to accomplish. And they put it not only into legalese, but they figure out where it fits in the statutes. It's Revised Statutes of Missouri. It's RSMO. And then there's a chapter number, which is usually, well, it's up to three digits, point something, something, something.
Okay, I think I've seen those.
And so they find where it fits in the statutes, and they put it in, use those numbers and that language. Because when they write the bill, they take the existing statute, and then they insert whatever needs to be inserted, and there are certain things that have to be deleted. In that case, the things that are deleted, they put in brackets. The things that are be inserted, they put in bold. Personally, I'd rather they strike through, because sometimes right. those little brackets are hard to find.
Yeah, it's like track changes, but the kind
right,
of
it's tracking your changes. Well, that's important, because when you're looking at a bill that's coming through, you want to know, what are they changing? What are they doing?
So you do read the bills.
I read, I definitely read everything that comes to my committees.
Okay.
And I always read those. The other bills, I at least read the summary. Mm-hmm. If it's something I'm particularly interested in, I will read the bill. If it gets a little controversial, I'll scan through and I'll find the pieces where they're adding stuff. Well, it's in bold print, so I can find it. Now, one of the committees I was on my first term was emerging issues in agriculture. And we had some kind of interesting bills. One of the things that I learned there, well, there weren't many bills, so it was easy to read them all, was you have to ask a lot of questions because they don't put everything out there where you can see it. I was on an appropriations committee. There was only two bills in that committee, House Bill 10 and House Bill 11. It was appropriations for health, mental health, and social services. House Bill 10 covers all of the health. House Bill 11 covers all the social services. Social services is one-third of the budget. It's around $8 billion. And those are the only two bills. Didn't see the bill until it was the day to vote on it. Thought that was kind of interesting.
Is that by design?
I think it was.
And by
how
who?
Often does that happen?
In that committee? Every year.
Every year.
Coming out of which committee? The Appropriations Committee?
Appropriations.
Okay. And you weren't on the Appropriations Committee?
I was on the Appropriations
okay.
Committee.
So where did it originate? If you were on the committee and that was the first time you saw it,
It originates in the budget office. And basically, they take they take the information from the previous year because it's line items. And if you take the paper, I got the budget itself, not just the bill part, but the budget itself, and I put it on the floor just to see how high it would stack, and it was about knee high, and I wasn't staining the paper on end, it was laying flat.
Right.
No, you cannot read that. You have to rely on people whose right. job it is to do that.
Right.
And it's, you know, how many workers do you have at what rate of pay in what department, and each little line item is in there,
right.
and there's an explanation for those. Children and Family Services, which is a committee I've been on since I got there, I'm still on it. We get about 40 to 50 bills a session. That's a lot of bills.
Yeah. So this budget office creates what they're going to put up there as the proposed budget for that year, and then it drops in your appropriations committee?
It comes from the governor.
Oh, so the governor through the budget office.
The governor's office.
So he proposes the budget and says, vote on this today.
Well, no, he proposes a budget, and we debate about it for about 6 or 8 weeks.
Okay.
And basically, when I was there, they were questioning people in the departments, asking them what they spend their money on, how do they spend their money, where's all the fraud. There seemed to be a big thing about fraud. And then found out later that the auditor had gone over that particular budget. It was social services, and found that there's fraud. It's $8 billion. And the fraud rate was somewhere between 1% and 2%. 1% and 2% fraud, you go to any retailer, and if their shrinkage is 1% to 2%, they're thrilled. It's a chunk of change out of $8 billion.
Right. It seems like, if anything, there's probably more waste than fraud, right? Or you don't think so?
I don't know. I got off that committee for a reason. I couldn't get anybody to explain it to where I could really felt that I could really, really understand it.
Maybe that's part of the point. I don't know.
I think that's what I'm getting at here. You are indicating that there's something shady going on. Maybe that's putting too strong a term on it.
I don't know that it's shady.
But it's not up front, at least. You talked about one bill you received kind of late in the game.
The bill itself.
The bill itself.
Not the supporting materials. Lots of supporting materials in advance.
Okay.
Lots and lots and lots.
But it seems like you're describing kind of like a Rube Goldberg, kind of an intentional Rube Goldberg kind of machine, where the governor proposes the budget, you guys debate, it goes to the budget office, then a bill kind of comes out and kind of lands on your desk, and you kind of feel, almost intentionally obfuscated somehow.
The governor works with the budget office.
Mm-hmm, right.
They work together. And the budget office is pretty independent. The governor says what he would like to see, he or she would like to see in the budget. And then the budget department puts it together. And then this whole thing, it's very complex. It's very large. It's a lot of money.
Right.
The departments, the budget goes out to the departments. The departments make their requests. Then they take those requests and put them together, and they look at what they've asked for with what the governor's asked for, because those are all the departments work out of the governor's office, because the state organization, I guess if you will, has the legislature, the courts, and the executive.
Mm-hmm.
The executive is over all the departments.
Gotcha.
And all of those departments, be they judicial or health, our education, our corrections, they're all under the governor. So they kind of work together. You know, the governor's not going to sit there, and he's not going to read all that either.
Right.
But each part and parcel, all these pieces all come together to make that budget.
So do departments ever say, hey, I had X million dollars last year, but I don't really need that much this year. I'm doing all right. Like, does anybody ever say they need less than they did before?
When they're told they have to cut the budget a certain amount, they're told they have to cut it at that amount, and they have to.
Okay. So it just arrives at them with a percentage cut, and they have to deal with it.
Right.
So do you feel as a legislator that you have at least your vote of control in this whole thing, or does it all just seem like it's swirling around you?
In the budget, actually, I don't vote for many of the budget bills. I usually vote against them.
Just on principle, or just...
Sometimes because I think they're wrong, and sometimes I think it's on principle.
Yeah.
I think that there are some things that we need to do better. We set up a foundation formula for the schools. The state set it up. They said, this is what we're going to do. And then we don't do it. I think that's a problem.
What do you mean? Like, you mean the Common Core requirements? Or what do you mean about
that? Not Common Core. Common Core is a separate thing.
Okay, what do you mean about the
formula? The foundation formula.
What does that mean?
The formula upon which the amount of money each school receives is based.
Gotcha. So each student is based on student heads at the school, right? Or
depending upon where the school is.
Okay. Okay, so they create some kind of formula to allocate a kind of a mathematical way of drawing funds out to the schools, and then that passes, and then when the budget's enacted, they don't really get money? Or
that was passed years ago, and it grew over years, and the budget has not grown to keep up with it.
Gotcha.
So the schools are not getting the money they should. St. Louis City and County, I'm going to go out on a limb a little bit here, but basically I believe that St. Louis City and County are the bread and butter of the state.
Woo-hoo.
Everything else is dessert. You know, the dessert comes from other counties, if there is to be any dessert. Because St. Louis City and County is where the most money is. Kansas City has money. The 8th Congressional District, from what I've heard, is the poorest congressional district in the country.
And where is that?
Southeast Missouri State. Mm-hmm. You know, if you stub your toe there, you're going to hit rock. There's no dirt on the ground. You can't plant anything in it. Yeah. North State, yeah, they grow corn like crazy. Mm-hmm. But South, no, not so much.
Right.
But then, you know, we're at the bottom of the list on a lot of things.
What, as a state?
As a state. We have the lowest gasoline tax at 17 cents. I think we're the lowest cigarette tax at 19.
Are you saying that's an issue, that we need to increase those?
Well, you know, I was on this committee the past year. I was on an ag issues committee the first term. My second term, I'm on different committees. Well, I'm still on children and families. I gave up the appropriations because they were making me crazy and taking up all of my time. And I decided, you know, I want to stay sane. So between that and my CASA, it was just an overload. And it's important to me to not drive myself nuts. But anyway, I was on this ag committee. So this year I'm on another ag. Well, it's not really ag. It's conservation and natural resources.
Okay.
So there was a bill about trucks that came through. And they wanted to increase the weight of the trucks.
You're talking tractor-trailer trucks.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Big trucks. Grain haulers, cow haulers, you know, right. Things like that. And MoDOT said, you know, that's kind of heavy for our roads. And the farmer said, we got to get the grain to market. We got to get the grain to market, and it's less trips, saves us money. And I sat there, and I looked at him, and I said, you know what? You put some of those big grain trucks on some of these roads going over these little creeks, and you're going to have that trailer fall into the creek, and you're not going to be able to get it out because both ends are going to be closed up because it's going to be the walls of the creek.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're not going to get it to market.
Right.
You need to have a road to do that. Well, they raised the weights anyway. So I'm just waiting. Instead, MoDOT has closed some bridges. There's one, in fact, that the detour is 31 miles one way around it.
So they closed the bridge because it wasn't rated at that maximum.
Well, it was falling apart.
Oh, yeah,
there's a safety issue there, too, because a lot of those trucks, when they're fully loaded, their brakes aren't strong enough to stop them anyway. So when you go adding even more weight to them.
Right.
We don't have to run away truck ramps.
Huh?
We don't have runaway truck ramps like they do in the mountains.
Yeah. True. Okay. So Rob has a question for you.
So I always like a little rivalry in things. Everyone does. And I think I sense a little bit of the House versus Senate rivalry. Are you just, why do you think, or do you think the House is just a better legislative body than the Senate? And I mean, does it speak more to the people? Is it more efficient? Are you just more of a fan of the House? Stick it to those Senate guys a little bit.
Why should I stick it to the Senate guys? They tend to think a little bit more about their bills than the House does.
Oh. I just thought maybe there was a little like bicameral rivalry going
on. Yeah, is there like a softball league?
Well, some people seem to think that the Senate, if you have two bills that are just alike, the Senate will pass their bill and they won't pass the House bill. So we get a lot of bills that are exactly
so
alike.
Why? Just so everybody feels like they're doing their thing? Or
you're dealing with a lot of A-type personalities.
So they want their
and
bills
you're
passed.
And you're dealing with a lot of egos.
So that's where the rival, if they're, maybe not a rivalry, but people want to feel like they've rolled their own bill. They're doing their own thing.
Is there a requirement in Missouri like there is at the federal level for bills that are going to spend Treasury money have to originate in the House?
The budget bills all come from the House.
Okay.
the budget bills all come from the House. Now, people pass bills and spend money, but I don't know where they're getting the money unless they find it in one of those House bills.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Jeremy, you got a question?
Well, I think we were getting at it there with the House versus Senate, but question 9 is state government as divisive and broken as I perceive the federal government to be, where it's more about the party and getting our party in control instead of doing something productive, something that will benefit America or Missouri or whatever state.
Well, it's definitely in control of one party. In fact, I heard someone quote someone whose name I won't say, and they said that this person stated, well, we have a supermajority. We can do whatever we please. And sometimes you sit there and you watch these bills go by, and it's like we're being steamrolled. You know, it's like this big steamroller is coming through, and there's nothing you can do to stop it.
Right.
So you feel like that, and you're part of the process. That's how I feel as a citizen.
You're not alone.
And you were talking about voting no on some bills on principle. How prevalent is that in the House or the Senate? Do you feel like a lone wolf, or do you have...
I'm definitely not a lone wolf. There's this thing called PQ. It's called the previous question. And the Senate rarely uses it. In the House, we keep a tally on it. And sometimes at the end of session, we'll look at it and we'll guess how many PQs there might be. You know, it's like a pool. I never participated in it, so I don't know how much it costs. But anyway, maybe $1. And they're guessing how many PQs are going to be. What happens with the previous question is during debate, someone can raise their hand and say, I called the previous... They raise their hand, they get called on, they say, I called the previous question, which means all debate stops. And you vote. You vote if you're going to call the previous question or not. And then if that vote passes, then you vote on the issue. If not, you go back to debate. I call them the D's instead of the Democrats because it's just shorter. And generally speaking, the D's all vote no, and the R's all vote yes. Because they don't want to listen to us anymore.
Right, as kind of just a way of just stopping the debate or stalling.
Stopping the debate. And sometimes, which I found very interesting, someone was called upon, they raised their hand. In the House, there's 163 of us. It's a very large room. And we have microphones. There's like maybe 6 or 8 people that share a mic. Whenever you want to talk, you go to the microphone and you have a piece of paper, preferably, in your hand so people can see you. I use bright colors myself.
Nice.
And you hold it up and you wave it around, and the speaker or whoever is in the speaker's seat at the moment calls on you to vote. And they never call you by name because that's inappropriate.
What
do they
say?
There's protocol. They will say, for me, the lady from St. Louis County. Sometimes they'll say Meredith District. If there's a couple of us standing close together and they don't know which one they're calling on. Because we've had people start talking, their microphone's not turned on. The microphones are turned off unless they call on you to speak. And I've lost my place.
So they call on you.
You were talking about PQs.
Yeah, they call on you, and you can do this previous question thing, and it stops. Now, one of the things that they don't seem to teach in school, and this drives me crazy, you got a bill, right? How does a bill become a law? Remember that? Well, first it gets read the first time, it gets read the second time, and then you vote on it, and then it goes to the other house, same thing, yada, yada, and then the governor or president signs it. Well, that's not how it works, actually. They read it the first time. What they do is they stand up in front and they say, House Bill number 1, House Bill number 2, House Bill number 3, House Bill number 4. And they just go through and say the number.
That counts as like reading it into the record.
That's the second reading, too. Then it goes to committee. Committee does what it does with it. They hear it. They listen to the public. If the chair chooses. they listen to it, they hear from the public, they hear from whoever. If they choose to pass it, and all votes are public, if they choose to pass it, then it used to go to the House. Now it doesn't. It now goes to a select committee. And the select committee, I think they were supposed to just rubber stamp it. I'm on a select committee for social services and for ag. And I was sitting in the social services, which is veterans, health care, policy, and children and families. And they brought up a bill. I didn't know anything about the bill. So I asked questions. I said, tell me, what does this bill do? Oh, we're just going to vote on it. I said, I'm sorry. I can't vote on it right until somebody tells me what it does.
Mm-hmm. You have to pass it so you can find out what's in it.
Exactly. I thought it was kind of weird because we'd never had select committees before. And I didn't know what bills were coming. You know, you get the notice, oh, there's a hearing tomorrow. Okay, you got to go. Maybe you have time to look at it. Maybe you don't. So I'm sitting there, and I'm like, okay, tell me what it says. Well, one of the people on the committee happens to be a physician, and he said, yeah, let's tell him what it is. So he was explaining it to me, and then we proceed along, and of course it passed because it's, you know, it's always maybe 3-1 or 2-1. I think it's about 2-1 in a committee because the committees consist of the same proportion of D's and R's as there are on the House floor. On children and families, there are four D's, so there's 8 R's. So no matter what, they cannot vote us. On ag, there's 3 D's, and guess what? There are 6 R's. So winning on that is a challenge, to put it mildly. If the chair chooses to hear it, it's pretty much going to pass.
Right.
So after this first reading, second reading, standing committee, select committee, then it goes to the House for perfection. For perfection, that's when we debate the bill. Now, what happens sometimes is the person who is sponsoring the bill stands up, tells everybody a little bit about what the bill is, and welcomes any questions. And then everybody can raise their hands and ask questions. Now, here's where that PQ comes in. When they get tired of listening to all the questions, somebody will PQ it, or maybe we'll actually finish the discussion, and then we'll just vote on it. There was one bill in particular. I can't remember what the bill was. I was so incensed. But I was sitting there at my chair, and the person stands up, and I said, you know, and says something like, you know, they say, okay, bring up this bill for discussion, and it's House Bill number whatever, whatever. And the person says, yes, I'm bringing up whatever. And then the next person next to him raises their hand and says, I PQ the question.
Didn't even get started yet.
No discussion. And then, of course, the D's voted no, and the R's voted yes, and then we had to vote on the bill. So we all voted against it.
Right. Which did nothing.
We could.
Right.
But it had no influence whatsoever.
Right.
Now, there's some things that are pretty controversial right now. The hot-button issue at the moment, veto session is next Wednesday, is the right to work.
Yeah. See a lot of those bumper stickers about right to work being a ripoff. That's the big one.
There's a lot of bumper stickers about that.
Yeah.
Back in the 1900s, a lot of people worked very, very hard to have the right to tell their boss what they think.
Right.
Sometimes they listen, sometimes they don't.
Have you decided how you're going to vote on that?
I'm the daughter of a bricklayer.
Okay.
Who has had a 50-year gold card. Yeah. Anyway, I don't see anything wrong with people talking and picking out people to... When I was on the school board, we had the NEA, the AFT, the MSTA, and what I call the GDIs. And the teachers would vote who would represent them at the table to negotiate with the board.
Right.
And the board would appoint people to represent the board. And they would talk. And they would tell us their ideas, would tell them our ideas, and would find some place in the middle. And I kind of think that's kind of good, because that way we got to hear what the teachers thought was important. Otherwise, we might not. The teachers never walked. But so anyway, this bill's coming up. They didn't have enough votes. There's 17. When the vote was taken last, there were 17 votes shy of being able to override. Now, in veto session, after all is said and done, there are bills that have been truly agreed to and finally passed. Everything that's passed goes to the governor. The governor either signs it or vetoes it. When it comes back on veto, it starts in the House where it originated. House bills come to the House, Senate bills go to the Senate. And we're not voting actually on the bill. What happens is the bill comes up and somebody makes a motion to override the governor's veto. So what we're voting on is that motion. We're not actually voting on the bill. So a no is yes, we want the bill to be law. A yes is no, we're sticking with the governor.
How many times does that get confused?
I screwed up.
Oh, man, I pressed the wrong one.
Well, you know, we talk to each other on the floor.
Yeah.
And if you mess up on a bill, like if you accidentally rush in and you know what they've been debating and you know you're going to vote for it,
yeah,
and you rush in and you push the button on your box on your desk and you get the wrong one, everybody around you goes, no, it's a PQ, and you go back and change it. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, we know each other well enough. We know on some issues that some people are going to vote one way.
Yeah.
No, regardless of their party,
right,
or another. And like with this right to work bill that's coming up, we don't know if it's going to be brought up or not. Because generally speaking, they don't bring anything to the floor unless it's going to pass. And when it doesn't, it's kind of a surprise.
Wait, I thought it did it pass the
it
Congress?
It passed.
And
it was truly agreed to and finally passed.
And then
the governor
vetoed it.
But it only had 92 votes. On a veto, you have to have two-thirds of both houses have to agree that they're going to override. So, in the House, because there's 163 members, the magic number is 109. It doesn't matter if it's 109 to zero. It's vetoed. I mean, it's overridden.
Mm-hmm.
If it's 107, it's not.
Right.
You have to have 109 of the 163. Now, there's some empty seats, so they're counted as absent. They have to be, yes, we're voting to override the veto.
So what is the risk? What is the risk for them putting it up for overriding the veto and having it fail?
They lose.
Just lose. Just doesn't look good.
Depends upon which way you're looking
at
it
from. So since we may be political colleagues, or at least in our mindsets. I mean, it seems like what you're describing, look, Jeremy shaking his head. It seems like I never thought about it before, but maybe we're a Democratic governor away from some pretty crazy things happening. Like, at least we have a balance of powers, if you will, between the governor and the Congress at this point. At least he can veto something, right? What if Roy Blunt was up there, Governor Roy Blunt?
Oh.
You know.
We probably wouldn't even have a veto session.
That's right.
But it's kind of interesting because everybody says this is a red state. It's really purple. Because we have five of the six statewides. Or we have six out of eight statewide offices that are held by Democrats.
Right.
So how do you have that many, the governor, not the lieutenant governor, the governor, the secretary of state, the attorney general, the auditor, and the treasurer, and a senator, a U.S. senator, are all Democrats?
Mm-hmm.
The lieutenant governor and the other U.S. senator are Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
But the House and the Senate are both Republican.
Right.
Predominantly.
Predominantly, right.
I mean, there's 118 of them. Well.
That's a lot of them.
So, did you vote on the Convention of States legislation that was proposed?
We haven't.
You haven't. Okay.
Go on.
Have you read much about the Convention of States legislation?
It's in the Constitution that we can amend the Constitution by having a convention of the states. It's also by passing an amendment by three-fourths of all the states. Personally, I think passing it by three-fourths of all the states is the better way to go.
It seems like you were holding back something on that.
Well, you know, they had this thing before the Constitution. I forgot what they called it.
Articles of Confederation.
Yep. And they were supposed to amend it. They didn't amend it. They wrote the Constitution. That could happen again. And personally, I think the Constitution is a masterpiece. To have those brains all come together at the same time in the same place, mm-hmm. and work out their differences and make something like they did with, with the Bill of Rights on there. I just think that it's miraculous to have something like that happen, and to have that happen again. And the way things are right now, it's a little squirrely.
I don't think you would get the agreement and the people putting aside their own personal interests and, ooh, what can I get out of this?
Too much greed.
Yeah.
Too much greed.
See, you think the Constitution is a masterpiece, a masterful document. How do you feel about the Second Amendment?
I think the Second Amendment's fine.
Okay.
I think people tend to read it and leave out the one phrase, but hey, you know. That's okay. You know, everybody can read things the way they want to. As my one daughter states, your perception is your reality. The phrase I have a little trouble with, of course, is a phrase that says, in order to form a more perfect militia, because guess what? We have a huge militia.
Yes.
It's a major part of our economy. I don't know how many times we need to be able to annihilate the world, but apparently a lot.
Many times.
So, you know, I think people have the right to bear arms. The Constitution gives us that right. And I think that we should honor.
Do you take exception with the Supreme Court's decision in the Heller case in Chicago about the individual right to keep and bear arms? Because that seems like it settled the debate that had been going on for, well, this was, what, 2 years ago when the Supreme Court ruled on this? And
I don't remember what it was.
Finally incorporated, quote, incorporated the individual right to bear arms. So it was no longer a debate about whether or not the Second Amendment refers to militia's right. It's settled law now that an individual has the right to keep and bear arms.
It gave precedent.
Whether or not they're a member of a militia. That's all I'm saying.
It created precedent.
But do you agree with it? It sounds like you don't.
Well, you know, it's okay with me. I mean, you know, you can swing your fist all you want. Just don't let it come in contact with my nose or anyone else's.
Yeah. We've talked about that on the show before.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to take a real quick break. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Sue Meredith. So stay with us. Talking with Sue Meredith, who is a member of the Missouri House of Representatives. And our next question for you, Sue, is how have you been affected by the unrest in Ferguson over the last year?
It's been an interesting trip. It makes me a little heartsick, like I said a minute ago. when I was at Webster University, we had a department chair who happened to be African-American. And so was his wife. And they lived in a very nice home in a very nice neighborhood. And he would be stopped by the police. Now, this man, before he was chair at Webster, he was in upper management at what is now AT&T. And he'd wear his three-piece suit, and he'd always had his shoes polished. I mean, he's the best-dressed professor I think we had on campus, because, you know, professors are, well, professors. They don't always dress formally. They don't always wear, you know, a suit.
Sure.
They wear a tie, because it was a management department. But, you know, slacks and a shirt and tie. But he always wore a three-piece suit. Always, you know, well-groomed. And he'd be driving along, and he would get pulled over by the police. Now, if you or I get pulled over by the police, we roll down our window and they say, give me your license or registration, right? Well, not him. Let's step out of the car, please. Assume the position. Why in the world would they do that? And what are you doing in this neighborhood? I'm going home. Well, where do you live? And he'd tell them the address. And they'd say, well, can you prove that? Well, it's on my driver's license. And, well, is this a fake license? No. I mean, he's driving a nice car. He's well-dressed. He's well-groomed. It was very, very, well, so many things, you know. Rude was one of them. Just bigoted is another. There are so many things. His wife, she wasn't quite as patient as he was, and she came real close to punching out a cop once, but because she got so mad, because this is ridiculous. This is just plain stupid.
Yeah.
And the whole thing in Ferguson, as far as Michael Brown is concerned, it's an issue. Why was he walking down the middle of the street? Who knows? What exactly happened? Don't know. Bottom line is, it's not really about Michael Brown.
Right.
And we had a woman, my husband worked with OFA in Chicago. He got a I don't know, what do you call it? What do you call them there? They're not, a, like a fellowship thing, where he went to Chicago and worked for OFA.
It was
a thing, you know, whatever. And he went there and he worked and he was a volunteer. And He met a woman there who, when Ferguson happened, she called her house and she asked him if she could come and stay with us. And my husband, being him, he said, sure. So she came and she moved into our house for about a month. And she would go up to Ferguson. Now, this was a young black woman. And she would go up to Ferguson and she'd knock on doors and she'd talk to people. And she'd sit down and have lunch with people. And she interviewed people. And she said she was writing a book, but I haven't seen it yet. But anyway, she participated in various marches, and, you know, she just hung around up there a lot. And she'd come back, and she'd talk to us about it, and she asked if she could interview us separately. And the first thing she asked me, she said, well, what do you think about what happened with Michael Brown? I said, it's not about Michael Brown. Michael Brown was a spark that lit a fire, that shed some light that should have been shed long, long ago. And bigotry runs all kinds of different directions. And the first thing we have to remember is that we're all people, and we all have to respect each other. And maybe we wouldn't have to have a government if we respected each other. I mean, seriously respected each other and everyone else.
Yeah.
If no one was rude and tried to race them away from the stoplight, if there was a stoplight, and no one tried to ever break into your home or called you a name or tried to attack you or anything, if everybody would just respect everybody else, we wouldn't have these issues. No matter how tall you are or how short or whatever, right. It makes no difference. And where you came from, this whole immigration thing is crazy. I mean, I was knocking on the doors, and I never know what's going to happen. But I knock on a door, and somebody comes to the door, and I introduce myself, and first time I went around, I said, I'm a candidate for state representative in your area. Second time I went around, it was, hi, I'm your state representative. After that, who knew what was going to be said? And I had a guy say, we got to do something about these immigrants. And I said, really? He said, oh, yeah, there are all these, you know, and he just went on and on about the immigrants. And finally I said, where'd your family come from? He said, well, my dad was, my grandpa was a slave. He came to this country as a slave. And I looked at him and I said, where'd your grandpa come from? Ireland. I said, okay, did we bring slaves from Ireland?
Yes.
He said, well, he was an indentured servant. And I said, really? My grandpa came from England and he was an indentured servant. He was 15. But he came to Canada because, well, that's where the job was. He didn't like it there because it was cold. So as soon as he finished up his indenture, he moved south. And kept going south until he found a job and got a little warmer. And he's telling me, well, you know, his grandpa did kind of the same thing. And I asked him, I said, well, where was your grandma from? Oh, she was from, it was a European country. Well, what about the other side? Where were they from? It was another two more European countries. And I looked at him. He's quite a bit bigger than me. And I looked at him and I said, you know what? You're an immigrant just like I am. And he said, I never thought of it that way. I said, where would our grandparents have been if this country wasn't here and let people come here to escape generally from poverty, sometimes from jail or prison, or just because they wanted to explore?
Yeah, I don't think people who have an issue with that, like you're saying, it's not about Michael Brown. This is not about the immigrants. It's what is then given or what is expected by the immigrants or to the immigrants or by the immigrants. I think that's the bigger issue.
Right, because by somewhere, somehow, we have been given the medal of American citizenship, and with that comes a lot of rights and responsibilities, as well as, like, incredible privileges. You know, whether it's community services or whether it's fair justice or whether it's health care and, you know, whatever it is. And so there's something that comes with that American citizenship that you're essentially almost granted by the government as we have it right now. And so I guess maybe that's what Jeremy's asking. Is like just once you cross the border, are you granted everything that an American citizen is granted by the government? Is there?
I was born here.
Right.
So,
right. Me too.
And I didn't have to do anything.
Right.
All I had to do was grow up and register to vote to be able to have a say. I know people who are here as refugees. I have a fairly close relative whose family came here as refugees.
I think we understand that we have a certain responsibility, and this is, Jerry would say, no, we don't, but okay, let's step just a little bit this side of anarchy. Say, we do have some responsibility in the world, but America is broken, and we can't afford this.
What do you mean afford?
Afford. Monetarily. America cannot afford this.
Afford, what is this?
All the services we provide. Taking people in who are consumers as opposed to producers.
You could say that we can't. It would be tough for us to pay for healthcare for purely American citizens on, you know, that just that closed group. Just if you had American citizens paying into the system and American citizens taking out of the system, it would be tough to sustain it, I believe, just in that closed system. So, but it seems like we're very willing to grant, you know, external people into that system, which will also require all the same services. It seems just unsustainable, right?
Yes.
And it seems like the priorities are a little whacked, right?
Yes.
Because as many homeless people as we have in this country and as many children who are going hungry in this country,
can we
take care of those problems before we start, you know, taking care of people who don't even live here?
Yeah.
Now, I'm saying all of this assuming we're going to spend any money at all on this stuff. I would prefer we not.
Right.
But if we are,
right,
let's at least take care of, you know, the folks who live here first and then take care of the immigrants second.
I think that, yes, the system is broken. I really do agree with that. But somebody who's hungry, somebody who's being abused are punished when they shouldn't be. If they're the victim of what we would consider to be crimes and they need refuge, to turn them away. I find that to be a bit of a problem when I am surrounded by people in Jefferson City who talk about family, who talk about church, who talk about the goodness of their God, and yet at the same time, they don't want to help people in need. Now, people don't leave their home and they don't leave their country on a whim. Right. They leave for a reason.
Yeah.
And no, I don't think that we should sit there and simply support them. I know two women that were born here. I don't know. They weren't immigrants, but they were people who were on the dole, so to speak. They each had children. These two women got together. They found an apartment they could live in. It had three bedrooms, one for them, one for the boys, one for the girls.
Mm-hmm.
This was their plan. They managed to find enough furniture that they could scrape together. They each got a job. One worked days, one worked nights, so that someone would always be there to watch and take care of the children. So they're taking care of the children. They have a place to live. They have a job. Okay? They're going to get off the dole. And what happens? Somebody said, what about the kids' health care? Because the people they were working for weren't going to provide any health care. So they looked at it and they thought, well, if something happens to my child and they break an arm, this could wipe us out. We can't do that. So they didn't take the jobs, they didn't take the apartment, and they stayed on the dole. So that's wrong. I think instead, maybe if we had something, and I don't quite know how to get there, but if you have something, if somebody is getting a dollar, for every dollar that they earn, reduce that dollar by maybe 50 cents, and then gradually reduce it by 75 when it reaches a certain point, and then gradually bring it down to nothing. Because what's happening, if you've got people who are living on the little bit of money they can get from TANF and their food stamps and their EBT cards, and you take that, and if they go just an inch above it,
right,
over $297 a month income, they lose everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So don't do that. Help them climb up that ladder by reducing their benefits a little bit at a time, instead of, oh, well, you made a dollar too much, I'm taking away all of it.
That's a great idea.
You can't do that.
I'm not... What you're talking about is a little bit nearer to me than you might believe. I'm the youngest in a large family. My oldest sister has been through several rounds of cancer. Because of that, she can't get health insurance. So she's on... I don't know if she's on Medicare now or what she's...
Medicaid?
Probably Medicaid, but she's old. I mean, she's...
Did she get the affordable health care?
Could she get
health insurance through that, maybe?
So I don't know what her status is right now. I haven't talked to her. But so a couple of years ago, she was trying to get a job, and she found a job. But because of that, it was going to kick her off, and she couldn't afford the health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, when she tried to find out what she would have to pay each month, nobody in the agencies could tell her. They said, "Well, we don't know the answers because we don't actually have people who try to get a job once they're getting benefits." That was their answer to her.
I wouldn't believe that.
You wouldn't believe that? Let me tell you, my sister is not somebody who would bend the truth.
No, I mean what they told her.
Okay. Well, that's what they told her.
Well, they'll tell you anything sometimes.
So there's a problem. I mean, that...
Yep. Well, some people get somewhat jaded, and they think, well, you know, I know this person has these foster kids. She's got six foster kids in her house because that gives her so many dollars a month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I see a problem with that. I see a problem with three 13-year-old girls being placed in the same house because you got mean girls on steroids or estrogen ocean, and that's just crazy. You don't do that. I mean, I've had my kids that I was CASA for placed in a home with two other girls when one of them was 13 years old, and it was a nightmare. It was horrible. I'm like, don't do that. Well, not many people will take teenagers, you know. I know, but you know, there's teenagers that are 15 and 16 and 17 and 12 and 14. Why don't you do like maybe 13, maybe 12 and 13 and 15 or something? You know, mix up the ages a little bit. Because you got these kids just butting heads. And this is one of the things I see wrong with the foster system. My kiddos, we call them kiddos because that's different from our kids, which are, you know, really our own. And these two kiddos were, well, they are twins. And together, if you count both of them, every placement they had in the last 4 years, and we'll see, this is September, in the last 4.5 years, were placed in, not counting where they are at the moment, which is they're both freshmen in college. They got into college. Everybody's thrilled to death. Graduated from high school. They went to college. In the 4.5 years I had them, which was like eighth grade until now, freshman in college, 23 placements. Can you imagine living 12 places in 4.5 years and trying to go to school? Trying to get a part-time job? Trying to be a teenager? It's unbelievable. And these kids, if something goes wrong, if they're a brat, which sometimes kids are brats, instead of saying, okay, let's sit down and talk with the foster parent and talk with the kid, work it out. Nope. You grab that kid by the scruff of their neck and you pull them out of that house and you put them in a different one. That doesn't accomplish anything. That teaches the kid all you have to do. If you don't like this place, you just talk back. Or you just, you know, do something disruptive.
Yeah.
And then you can get a new home. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, it's going to be better than the last one.
Of course.
It always is.
And it's the same. It's the same. And I hear all these things, all these horror stories, and I see the kids, and I see the kids personally. I mean, I know these kids. I go to court for them. They're in school, and I'm going to court for them next week. And I'm calling them. I'm saying, okay, so what do you want me to tell the judge this time? You know, what's going on with you? Are you happy? Are you having fun? You know, is school working out for you? Oh, classes are boring. Come on, give me something else to work with. But, you know, they're difficult children. And they're going to have a hard time for a long time in their lives because not only do they have to deal with all this moving around and all those different people all the time, they got their parental issues to deal with. And then there's always that tattoo on their forehead that says foster kid.
Yeah.
The one that they see and nobody else does. So these things all come together, and we have to find a way to take care of these kids better than what we're doing. We have to do a better job. We have to take the time, and yes, it comes up front early. You have to take the time to sit down and talk with the kid and talk with the parents and talk with the authorities, because a lot of times the parents are on drugs, or maybe the parents are just, you know, no one's home. Sometimes that happens, too. Sometimes the parents have anger issues. Sometimes they have mental issues. It's all kinds of things. Sometimes the parents don't know they have the kids. The moms do, but sometimes the dads don't. I had one dad that stepped forward when he found out. We had to do the 5 DNA tests to find the father. But when he found out he was the dad, he stepped up to the plate and he said, "That's my kid, and I'm going to take care of that kid." And I was told by the attorney for the kid, well, you know, he was a drug addict. I said, he was. Well, I don't know. He did all the drug tests. He always came back clean. He went to NA, which I'd never heard of, Narcotics Anonymous, and he did everything. Would say jump, and he'd say, how high on the way up? And they decided, okay, well, they took my word for it. They said, well, give it a try just because you're insisting. And the judge said, okay. We're going to start out with an hour visit. And that little guy would just scream for the entire visit. And Dad was never late. He was there for every visit. And he needed some hand-holding and he needed some help. But he got it. And that's a wonderful little family. And it's good because we took the time to listen. And my older kiddos, take the time to listen. Listen to what they really, truly need. You don't just hand it to them on a platter.
Well, so that goes back to what Rob was starting to talk about if only there were some incentive, you know, like some, this was right before you started recording, and we kind of restructured the conversation, but you were saying if there were some incentive to do better, and you were talking about people being nice to one another, and if there was some incentive to do that. Right now, we aren't incentivizing people because we do hand, things are handed.
How would you incentivize them?
Well, one, you have to create a need. So endless, here it is not incentive.
Do you know how much it is?
I don't.
You can't have more than $297 a month in income on top of your TANF. And TANF is based upon your income. And it's like, I don't know, a dollar a day. You can't eat on that. And your food stamps, think about this one. You get food stamps and you get TANF money. Comes on a credit card type thing.
EBT, right?
Your EBT card.
Yes.
Now, there was talk, there was a bill that said no cash back on your EBT card. Okay. They need to get a job, right? Okay. That sounds good. You know? They need to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Yeah, that sounds good. They ain't got no boots, but hey, that's okay. Then you find out that what happens is with your EBT card, if you make it all plastic, and so therefore, you can use your TANF money, but you need to be able to get cash back so that you can buy the money order, so that you can pay your electric, so that you can pay your rent. You have to get a money order to do that. And to get that, you have to be able to get the cash off the TANF card. EBT, you take that to the grocery store. Oh, they're all using it for tobacco and liquor, right? Well, guess what? You can't buy toilet paper with that. Right. Now, if you
I
can't,
was a cashier. I'm familiar with EBT
right.
card.
You can't buy toilet
Wick,
paper. You
I'm
can't buy
with quite a
lot of stuff. You can't buy and soap.
I'm not saying to cut it off completely, but we're treating symptoms instead of problems.
And how would you treat that problem? First of all, you got to find out what it is. And that takes time.
It does.
And it costs money to do that.
It does cost money.
And the problem is great. So you do the quickest thing you can to get the emergency care you can, and then later you come back and try and work out the rest of it. If you're profusely bleeding, yeah, stop the bleeding. You go to the hospital, then you look at it and see what's
okay.
causing the bleeding.
So we're bleeding right now.
Mm-hmm.
We keep making the wound bigger.
No, we're not really making the wound bigger. We just have more of them.
So
more wounds.
Okay.
I mean, I agree with you. There is a problem, and we need to fix it.
Okay.
And as a CASA, I am trying to do something to help fix it. On a very, very personal level.
And see, I think that's great. That's a form of charity. You are stepping in where no one else
it's
will.
It's me taking care of another person. That's not charity. That's called caring.
I don't know how you draw a distinction between the two,
there's no
but okay.
money.
Right.
Huh? Well,
there's no money.
But you're
there's
donating
no
your time and your energy.
It's a charitable act.
Because I care.
Well, yeah. That's a charitable act.
Okay.
So,
but,
that's
I mean, charity sounds...
But you're not doing it as a government agent.
No.
Right. And that's okay, the difference.
So that's,
it's
that's
like,
my
like
point.
What
that's
if we had point. More of you just doing what you're doing?
Oh, the world would be such a much nicer.
That's right. I think it'd be fantastic.
Do you know how much citizens of the United States donate to charity every year? $300 billion.
How much of it's spent on administration?
I don't know, but that's
not
the
point. That's the question.
$300 billion.
Then why do we have homeless?
Well, that's a good question. I can't answer that.
Why don't we take that billions of dollars and buy apartment buildings, put them in there, give them some clothes, give them a bath, so they can go apply for a job without smelling up the place?
Well, because...
You're going to hire somebody who stinks
because
they can't buy soap?
Because the people running those charities decide how that money is spent.
Well, see, there you go. We let them have some independence. Darn.
Well... How else would you do it? Well, I know how you would do it. You would take the $300 billion and spend it the way you think it should
well,
best
I,
be spent.
I would provide homes for them. I would provide job training for them. I'd go around my district.
So you're treating the problem there. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
Okay, so we agree. But
that's
when
what
I brought
saying.
That up, you said it to me like I was crazy for thinking we should treat the problem instead of the symptom.
No, we need to treat the problem, but the problem is one of the other problems feeding into that is that we can't. It's such a huge problem. You have to have such a huge amount of money, and the people who run the state are not going to give any more money because they are busy. Excuse me, everybody out there who does this, collecting money from people who have big money so they can have big campaigns and spend $100,000 plus for state reps race. I know some of you spent $250,000 to win a seat that pays $36,000 a year. That's total insanity.
The last election, I started collecting. I had a pile of all the mailers I got for all the local elections and the state elections, and it was absurd.
It's insane. Now, I don't. Maybe I'm just lucky, and I'm told it's because I have a Democratic district. Well, it wasn't getting as many Democratic votes before I came along. I think when I first ran for office, it's got a name, I don't know what it is, but it was something like 54% Democrat. Okay, well, I happened to run against an incumbent. The district lines changed because we had a census, and the person who was running had been drawn out of the district. Her home was outside the district. I live in the district. I've lived in this district since dirt. Well, not quite. I move around a lot, but the district lines kind of, it looks like a prehistoric amphibian. But anyway, I lived here.
Gerrymandering never hurt anybody, right?
Oh, I've got like 16 houses south of Olive. Figure it out. It's very strange. Anyway, this person ran, and she won because it was she won her previous seat. Then they redrew the lines. He drew her outside the district. So she was the incumbent, but she didn't live in the district. I lived in the district. I've been in the district a long time. I have four school districts. I graduated from one. Two of my children graduated from another where I was on the school board. And the third school, my youngest daughter graduated from. The one school district, we don't have any connection. I mean, it's just part of the district. But so I won, and then when I ran again in 14, I got 59.1% of the vote. Why? Why do I have a group of Republicans in a more Republican part of my district that had got together and got all the Democrats to put signs in their yard for me? Because when I knock at the door, I don't say, I'm a Democrat, and you have to vote for me. I say, hi, I'm Sue Meredith. And then they start telling me things. It's very strange. But we talk about whatever they want to talk about. We talk about immigration. We talk about poverty. We talk about schools. We talk whatever it is that's on their mind, we talk about. And if they say,
like the podcast. Yeah.
They say, but I can't vote for you because you're pro-choice. And I said, I'm pro-choice for a lot of reasons. I think that people should have choices in life, what they do with their body, what religion they practice. You can go to school, or you can go to public school, you can go to private school. There's all kinds of choices. And then they got all hung up when I told them a little story about if there are 15-year-old girls in this world who no one has ever told them they love them. No one's ever held them in their arms and said they were loved. And you got a girl who's 15 years old and she's, you know, seeing things around her by that age. And some guy comes up, he could be 15, he could be 17, he could be 60. Doesn't matter. Comes up and tells her she's pretty or she's cute or she's smart. Puts an arm around her shoulders and all of a sudden, somebody maybe cares about me. A few months go by, you got a pregnant teenager. She has no home, no means of support, and we're going to make her carry that child. Maybe that's not such a smart thing to do, because we're going to add to the poverty and we're going to add to the problems. But she should have the choice of what she wants to do with that situation. Does she want to continue with that pregnancy or not? That should be her choice. It's her body. It's her life. It's not mine. I don't know what that choice should be, because it's not mine. And the choice I might make might be somebody different from somebody else's, but they need to have that right to choose. And I think that's real important. And these people stood there and they looked at me and they said, I never thought about that. And I said, well, maybe you should, because some children don't know what it's like to be loved. And situations like that come up. And yes, it does happen.
Some 38-year-olds don't know either. But
so when we're trying to isolate whatever we think this, you know, not the symptoms but the problems, like more globally, do you think the problems that are causing us to be maybe a wounded country or a broken country, do you think they're uniquely American in some way?
Nope.
No? Do you think England, France, Germany, Spain, Mexico, Canada are all having our same issue? In varying degrees, of course. But, is it the same root cause? Or are we doing something uniquely stars and stripes here?
Yeah, we're kind of unique from Europe. They have national health care.
Indeed.
Oh. I mean, I got hurt in England. I had a bar stool drop on my foot. We won't say who dropped it, but he knows who he is.
Your heel didn't get caught on it?
No, not that chair. I didn't see that one coming. And I was in a pub, and I had lunch. I had two plates of food in my hands, one in each hand, and it was this, like, inch and a half thick wood bar stool, and it landed right across my toes. Ow. And I just took the plates and I put them on the counter. There was a shelf around the edge of the room, and I just grabbed hold of it and just kind of put my head down on it, and, you know, just, oh, it hurts so bad. Woman leans over next to me and she goes, "Hon, if you need something for pain, I can help you out." I said, "Oh, well, thank you," and proceeded along, and wound up going to the hospital because I just couldn't walk, and my foot's starting to act like a balloon, and it's just blowing up. And we had just gotten to England, and I was so excited, my first international trip, you know, when I get to England, and, well, anyway. So we went to the hospital. Taxi couldn't take us to the emergency entrance because, well, you know, that's only for ambulances. If it's an emergency, you're going to be in an ambulance. So I kind of had to hobble in. Got in there and said there'll be a five-hour wait. I thought, oh, wonderful. But there wasn't anybody there, and I got in and out in 45 minutes. They determined that I was going to survive. Had to beg for crutches because, well, I couldn't walk, but they wanted me to stay off my foot. I said, I didn't come across the pond to sit in my hotel room. You know, I haven't got that much time. I need the crutches. I know how to use crutches. And when we went to leave, we're asking, you know, how much is the bill? And they looked at us like we had three heads. There was no bill. Now, in all the buses and all the taxi cabs and all the subways, it says, if you go traveling to the U.S., buy health insurance first. Mm-hmm. Buy health insurance first. You'll regret it if you don't. You know, all these kinds of signs everywhere. And that was in 1999. Those signs are still there. And I've since learned that, sure, if you're in England or in France or in Italy or most any place in Europe, there is a national health care. You can have your own private physician. You can get more if you want to pay for it.
Yes.
It's there if you want to pay for it, but there is a minimum base. And I'm kind of thinking that's not such a bad idea.
I just happen to have some international friends, and as the healthcare situation over here has been prevalent recently, we've talked to them and said, well, how does it work in your country? They're from Finland. And ask them how it works in their country, and they say, well, it's all right, but most people pay to have their own insurance because it's not quite what you need. So that's great, but I think people tend to paint a rosy picture of it, and they leave out the nitty-gritty details of, well, it'll do in a pinch, but let's not pretend it's the end-all, be-all.
I did come home and get x-rays, and everything was okay. But I also got the crutches so I could get around.
Yeah.
So I could manage, but I'm used to more than that. So, I mean, but a base, I don't think a baseline hurts anybody.
All right, well, Sue, I want to thank you very much for joining us this evening, spending time talking to us. We really enjoyed it. And
One last question. Do you have any predictions for the presidential race?
Well, there'll be one.
There will be one.
And I think it's going to be real amusing. I mean, Donald Trump is so much fun to watch.
He is.
You're right.
You just can't get too serious about it, but he is fun to watch. And I want to go back and listen to his interview by Sarah Palin. I think that has got to be. I haven't heard it yet, but I've heard about it. It's got to be real interesting.
All right. So, any predictions about Hillary's?
She's going to run.
Okay, fair enough. Well,
I have met her and
oh, yeah?
just shook her hand. She's got the greatest handshake.
I bet.
She has a really good handshake.
She's had a lot of time to practice it.
She does. And she looks you right in the eye. And you feel like she's seeing you, which is that's a wonderful trait for someone in her position. I don't know. There are so many things. It's so far. Well, it's not that far away anymore. But I wish we had shorter times.
Yes.
I wish that sometimes, I don't know, what I spend on a campaign, I think is about right. My constituents do not want their mailbox full. They do not want robocalls.
Nope.
They do not want all kinds of...
Speaking as one of your constituents, I can confirm that.
Tell you what we what else we don't. We don't want TV commercials when we're trying to watch the football game or anything else.
And a state reps race, we've got 36 to 37,000 people. TV in St. Louis, for us to purchase TV time, is a little on the not-too-smart side.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a lot on the not-too-smart side. I run my campaigns with one goal in mind, and that is to try and represent myself as a person who wants to represent my constituents. They are the people who are important, not me. They are the people that it's about. I need to listen to them. They need to know that I will be open and honest with them, even if we don't agree, and I will tell them, okay, I voted this way on the bill, and I know you don't like that, but, you know, here's why I voted that way. And personally, I would rather vote for somebody, and I have done it in the past, I would rather vote for somebody who will tell me the truth, even if I don't agree with them, than somebody who's going to try and just make me feel good. Because basically they're lying to me.
That's why Donald Trump is leading.
Well, he's just saying whatever pops into his head. I don't know what's true and what's fake and what he really believes and what he doesn't. Because it seems like it just kind of pops into his head and falls out of his mouth.
Right.
I agree.
But maybe that's a form of authenticity.
A form of truth, right. And authenticity.
So do you have any aspirations for higher office, federal house?
You know, 36,000 people is a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
And I don't think that I could give the personal attention to a larger universe.
Right.
And I personally answer all of my emails, all of my phone calls,
from Jerry.
Of my letters.
Yeah, I'm sorry about all those.
But, you know, I do have, I mean, if I'm getting, what really bothers me is I get a whole bunch of emails from the same, it's the same exact words. Some organization has posted something and they say, click here to send the letter.
Right. Yeah.
And I get these letters. They all say the exact same thing. Now, maybe the people feel the same way, but they should tell me in their own words.
Yeah, right.
And I go to answer them, and it doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
Because the organization puts their post thing on
there.
Yeah, whatever,
right, their email, right.
But it doesn't work, and I can't answer them. I can't respond to them.
Right.
Unless from some other resource I happen to have their email address.
Right, right, of where it's presented, right.
Everybody now has these cell phones, which are not listed. And when you call the house, you might get, you're only going to get one person in the house. You're not going to just get the household.
Right.
And so that makes it hard. And the only way you can get the emails is if they email you. So you can't send out a mass email until they email you. So what I have done is I have a web page and I ask people to comment and send me emails. And I've gotten some emails that way. I do a survey every year saying, here's some issues I think you might think are important. Tell me what you think. If there's something else bugging you or that's interested you, let me know. Give me your email address so I can respond to you personally. Mm-hmm. And then I write newsletters. But, you know, it's hard to be able to reach out to them and not fill up their mailbox. Yep. You can't do the robocalls because I just won't do them. I just don't. Right. And I go and I knock on their doors.
Yeah. Sounds like you're doing it the right way. And to go bigger, you'd have to start making those compromises.
And you'd have to haul in that kind of money. And I just really have a hard time asking people for money. I'm not good at it. I'm just not. I could never do sales. Yeah. I would starve. I can sell ideas, but I can't sell things. I couldn't even sell the Girl Scout cookies. It was so bad.
Those things sell themselves.
I know, but you know, because they're Thin Mints, you know.
Thin Mints are the best.
I like the Samoas.
No.
Tagalongs.
Oh, I can't believe it.
See?
These heathens, three different
opinions.
That's right.
Nothing new here. All right. I think we have reached the end of another episode. Once again, I want to thank you, Sue, for spending time with us, answering our inane questions. and I want to thank GC for hosting us. And thank our listeners for putting up with us once again.
And it's September 11th.
September 11th. 14 years ago. It's hard to believe that much time has passed. All right. We will see you next time.
Good night.
Bye now.
Thank you.
I can still say no?
Yes, that's called a veto. If the president vetoes me, I have to go back to Congress and they vote on me again. And by that time, you're so
By that easy. Time, it's very unlikely that you become a law. It's not easy to become a law, is it?
No.
But how I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
He signed your bill. Now you're a law.
Oh, yes.